These are some really big shoes to try to even come close to trying to fill and follow. It's been such an amazing meeting that I've forgotten that I was on the program. And so this is my stressful part. I feel very unqualified to speak here today, but I'm grateful to have been asked. Just to give you a little bit of background, my name's Aaron Bishop. I was raised in Baltimore, Maryland. My parents were both converts to the church. I'm the second oldest of seven children. I served an LDS mission to Geneva, Switzerland, which included beautiful countries like France and Monte Carlo. For bad behavior, you could get sent to the Reunion Islands, and so that's how bad it got. I returned from that awesome experience and met my wife from Long Island, New York at BYU in French class. I tease everyone that we've been Frenching ever since. And as a result, we have seven wonderful kids. Two awesome son-in-laws, and we're expecting our first grandchild today, which is where she is, and so can't tell you how excited I am about that. Our love of travel, countries, languages, and cultures has been a theme for our family. I studied French mostly at BYU, and I received a master's degree from Johns Hopkins University in political science. My wife and I ran a small business outside of Baltimore at the time, and while trying to raise five little kids, I took night classes at the DC campus of Hopkins, and while volunteering as a legislative assistant to my congressman on Capitol Hill, I served as a counselor in the bishopric, while my wife served in at least one or two prominent callings in the ward as well. I focused my master's thesis on the separation of church and state, arguing in part that while our nation was built upon religious principles, our government was formed as a necessary evil to protect our religion and our freedoms and not the other way around. Religion was not created to serve the interests of government, and like the states, it ought not to cede their divine sovereignty to any government. In my thesis, I quote Ezra Taft Benson and Cleon Skousen, among other Latter-day Saint leaders who inspired me in my research and who I believed patriotically defended America as that great city on a hill. A truly special place with a divine mission and with the Constitution the Lord tells us is a glorious standard inspired by God. Everything I say today is colored by that little bit of background and by those beliefs. I love my religion, I love my family, I love my book, the Book of Mormon, I love the Lord, and I've loved my nation that I've spent much of my life studying, defending, and comparing to the other countries that I've traveled to and lived in. Joseph Smith was warned by the angel that the fullness of the Gentiles was about to come in, and then at some point would be fulfilled. The Book of Mormon is a warning to our nation of its pending destruction, for having let the secret combinations of old get above us. My concern for the church I was raised in and love is the same as my concern for my nation. Satan seeks to overthrow both and all institutions of religion and government, and hence the reason both institutions were so carefully constructed in an inspired way to include checks and balances, a system of planned frustration as it pertains to making changes, judges with smaller courts, checking the larger, and the diversity of smaller competing and equal interests, such as stakes and states, wards and counties, all to ensure self-government by rule of the voice of the people through elected leaders and by common consent, and to avoid rule by decree, or as the Book of Mormon would call it, rule by a king, which, as we know, is hard to dethrone without the shedding of much blood, because he has his friends in iniquity, and he keeps his guards about him, and he tears up the laws of those who have reigned in righteousness before him, and he tramples under his feet the commandments of God. The power that any president or Congress or quorum has that is left unchecked for any reason destroys common consent. At Hopkins, we would always say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. My religion has taught me that we have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men. As soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. The multitude of changes that have taken place so quickly over the last 4 years in the LDS Church have many members both excited and reinvigorated. Others, however, have concerns that these rapid changes reflect the further erosion of common consent in the church and fear that too much power to make changes may now be concentrated in the hands of too few. When President Nelson became the 17th president of the church 4 years ago, every major news outlet that was covering the story all assumed that the 93-year-old, quote, company man wasn't expected to move the church in any major new direction. Jana Reese from the Salt Lake Tribune admits how wrong she and other journalists were. She said, in a denomination that has for the past half century implemented change glacially, if at all, he, Nelson, has moved forward on a number of fronts. To Reese's point, Russell Nelson became an apostle in 1984 when he was called with his friend Alan Oaks to fill the vacated seats of LeGrand Richards and Marky Peterson. He had been a member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles for 34 years when he was called as the church's new president. During that time, he and the church did in fact make changes glacially, and Elder Nelson, based on all that he'd ever done or said in those 34 years, was simply not predicted to do anything differently. The changes in the church under President Nelson, however, have been so rapid, so surprisingly abundant, and so far-reaching that many are referring to this as a, quote, revelatory season like none other. These unexpected adjustments do provoke an important question. What has changed to the process of making important decisions in the church, where we go from glacial changes to the rapid and extensive changes we now witness? Before getting to that question and a few others, let's first take a closer look at some of the changes that have been made. Church has gone from 3 hours down to two. High priest quorums have been eliminated. The age of Aaronic priesthood and temple attendance for youth has been lowered. Witnesses for baptisms can now be as young as 8 years old, boys and girls, similar changes to the law of witnesses in the temple. Further changes to the temple ceremony and to temple clothing. The church has quit Boy Scouts after 100 years. The word Mormon has become unacceptable in referring to the church. Home teaching has been changed to ministering. The way youth interviews are conducted has been changed. Missionaries are now able to call home weekly. Sister missionaries are now able to wear pants, and elders and sisters are able to wear more casual clothing. The church now refuses to allow bishops or stake presidents or anyone in the church to grant any religious exemptions from vaccines that are derived from aborted fetal tissues. Guns are no longer allowed on church property. The church now partners with the United Nations and supports in part their 2030 sustainability agenda. I think President Benson might roll over in his grave on that one. They're friendly towards Black Lives Matter and call it an eternal principle. They partner with the NAACP, and they allow critical race theory to be taught openly at BYU, something that my friend Matt Lohmeyer has talked about and has stood up against in the military. Church pageants have been canceled permanently. A small change, and this may be considered trivial, but I think it gives a little bit of a feel for President Nelson's preferences and his leadership style. But if you'll remember, in one of his first conferences, he instructed the church that no one should gasp or make any noise expressing excitement when new temples are announced. I don't know about you, but I always looked forward to that time when they would announce all these temples and you could hear the people from the DRC and from Kentucky and wherever. And it was such a wonderful, exciting thing that I think reflected beautiful and appropriate responses from very real people. Adults, I might add, some of whom have never had a temple within 1,000 miles. As a side note, President Nelson has announced or has under construction 104 or more temples, almost double the amount that currently exists at 165. The angel Moroni is no longer being added to most new temples. Dramatic changes to Temple Square have taken place. General handbook changes and BYU honor code changes, which have caused some confusion specifically for gay students at BYU. The revelation was received to allow children of gay couples to be baptized, which has been criticized since it was Elder Nelson who said he was in the room when President Monson received its opposite revelation a few years earlier. President Nelson and the LDS Church leaders have broke a long-standing unwritten church law by meeting in Rome at the Vatican with the Pope for the first time in the history of the world. And during that visit, they referred to him as, quote, His Holiness. The church is now rebranding the church president as a global faith leader. The church has changed its logo, adding the Christus statue to it, and has issued another proclamation to the world. There are many other things we could mention, but this list gives us a little bit of a foundation for today's topic. In the Doctrine and Covenants, we read, "And all things shall be done by common consent in the church." We read in the restored edition of the glossary that common consent is a principle of decision-making where all participants in a particular group, example given could be ward, fellowship, or conference, are eligible to either affirm or reject an action or proposal. Such action can be sought after with either a majority or a unanimous vote. We give consent when we yield that which we have a right to withhold. The early church governed themselves by common consent, with no man dictating to them. Equality prevailed, and authority was dispersed into equal and independent groups that prevented autocratic rule and guarded against apostasy of the whole body. They conducted all their business in conferences. Someone would be elected by common consent to preside at the conference and to conduct the business. Business could be introduced by anyone, which could include complaints, suggestions, and discipline. The purpose of conferences was to take care of the business and to make sure that the community was cohesive and that issues were dealt with. Although both Joseph and Oliver had the priesthood conferred upon them by the voice of God, they only obtained an office in the church by common consent from the body of the church. And when the founding prophet was in direct communication with the Lord, the church body still retained the final control through common consent. And this is the last part. This right of common consent is so fundamental that it holds greater right than a first presidency, a 12, a 70, or a high council. All authorities derive their institutional right to preside solely from the consent of the governed. It is through common consent that any right to government is established in the church, close quote. All things being done by common consent in the church is the standard for the Lord for how the power to change things in the church is to be wielded. I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves, said Joseph. People having a voice and their agency to self-govern and to express their opinions without reprisal and to be a part of the decision process are fundamental eternal principles, the opposite of which is the adversary's plan to control everyone and everything. During Joseph's day, important church decisions regarding buildings, callings, missionary work, worthiness, the gathering, organizing stakes, resolutions, land purchases, public officers, bills of incorporation were all conducted at conferences through the means of voting by the members in attendance, with the majority or the voice of the people determining the decisions. On one occasion, Joseph actually called upon the church to voice any complaints or concerns about him continuing as church president. In effect, he was willing to step down and was considering resigning from office. After a debate, Brigham Young eventually arose and nominated Joseph Smith to continue as the president of the church. Orson Hyde seconded the motion, and then it was put to a vote. The Joseph Smith papers reveal that, quote, such a show of hands was never seen before in the church. The other counselors were then presented for trial and were eventually sustained. Joseph then concluded, I don't know anything against the 12. If I did, I would present them for trial. Another great example of the church doing things by common consent is when Joseph Smith himself asked the church during a general conference to release Sidney Rigdon from the first presidency. Effectively, Joseph raised his hand in the opposition to his own counselor in front of the entire church. Joseph had concerns with Rigdon, and the matter was brought before the conference of saints. Rigdon had a chance to defend himself, taking as much time as was needed. Others all had a chance to present evidence for and against him. Rigdon closed with this, a moving appeal to President Joseph Smith concerning their former friendship, associations, and sufferings, and he expressed his willingness to resign his place, though with sorrowful and indescribable feelings. During this address, the sympathies of the congregation were excited. Joseph Smith then expressed entire willingness to have Elder Sidney Rigdon retain his station, provided he would magnify his office and conduct and walk himself in all honesty, righteousness, and integrity, but signified his lack of confidence in his integrity and steadfastness, judging from their past intercourse. After several motions, the conference voted that Elder Rigdon be permitted to retain his station as counselor in the First Presidency. Joseph did not unilaterally remove a counselor in the First Presidency, although it was his preference and although he was president of the church. The decision needed to include the entire membership of the church, many of whom had voted for Elder Rigdon to begin with. It's also interesting to remember that Sidney Rigdon, by this time in 1843, had been in the presence of Christ and received a revelation that we know as Section 76 with Joseph Smith. Over time, however, we can see that this process of member involvement and true consent in making decisions has changed. All the power to make important decisions, right or wrong, seems to now be entrusted to the brethren. In fact, just the other day, a friend sent me a news story stating that the local leaders of the church would finally be able to make their own decisions regarding masks in their local meeting houses, which, unfortunately, the article noted, would fall to the stake presidents who would consult with the area presidencies and not to the bishop and the Relief Society president, and most importantly, the members themselves. And then in the same article, it reports that, quote, face coverings will remain a must in temples, end quote. Again, no vote, no opportunity or ability for local temple patrons or matrons or temple presidents and their counselors to prayerfully decide what is best for them and their circumstances. And let's not forget that even the many scientists in whom we are now strangely told to trust state that the masks and the lockdowns have done very little to slow the spread of the coronavirus. And so if masks do work and vaccines are safe and effective, then why not let people decide for themselves whether they want to wear a mask or not while attending the temple or church or anywhere? We also saw this same kind of thing that happened recently with the Manti Temple, when the church had unilaterally decided to take out pioneer murals that were well over 100 years old in a temple remodel. The local members were not asked. They were only told what was about to happen. Many were very upset and protested, which led to the brethren deciding not to take the murals out. A lot of this stress and public embarrassment could have been spared if local members had been included in those decisions in the first place. With the power to make changes now solely the responsibility of the brethren, as it appears for most matters, we can only hope that their process is a thorough and rigorous one. We often hear about the unity of the 15 apostles and are told that they never make a decision until everyone agrees. President Eyring and Elder Scott have described their experiences with the brethren in the past and how they have debated in such a way that left them feeling very, very uncomfortable. On one occasion, Elder Scott, at a fireside I attended, on his first meeting, he says, with the Quorum of the Twelve in the First Presidency, he was so dumbfounded and so shocked at how heavy the debate was that Elder Packer slipped him a note that said, "Richard, welcome to the Quorum," to try to calm his anxiety. Elder Eyring has said it this way. He said when he first attended as the president of Ricks College, it was the strangest conversation he had ever heard, where the prophets, and I'm quoting of God, disagree in an openness that he had never seen in business at Stanford or Harvard or anywhere. In business, you're careful when you're with the bosses, you know. I just watched this process of them disagreeing, and I thought, good heavens. I thought revelation would come to them all, and they'd just see things in the same way. I was just dumbfounded. But then after a while, the conversation cycled around, and they began to agree. And I saw the most incredible thing. Here are these very strong, very bright people, all with different opinions. Suddenly, the opinions began to line up, and I thought, I've seen a miracle. I've seen unity come out of this place. I've seen unity come out of this wonderful, open kind of exchange that I'd never seen. It was President Harold B. Lee who was chairing the meeting. I thought, now he's going to announce the decision because I've seen this miracle. And he said, wait a minute. I think we'll bring this matter up again some other time. I sense there is someone in the room who is not yet settled. And they went on to the next item. And I thought, says Elder Eyring, that is strange. And then I watched somebody, one of the brethren, I think one of the 12, walk past President Lee and say, thank you. There's something I didn't have a chance to say. This method of debate and open dialogue and a reluctance to make a decision until all concerns are resolved, for me, feels very healthy. And I love that we've been told that the brethren never proceed forward on any matter until everyone is in agreement. Hence the reason things have tended to change so glacially in the church. I've heard at times that the brethren will put things on the shelf for decades. Some of these decisions are small ones, and some of these decisions are big ones. But the fact that all the brethren who are so seemingly competent, older, experienced, and wise must come to agreement unanimously gives local leaders and members who have ceded their power to make these changes to a large degree some level of confidence and comfort, kind of like how we're supposed to feel when something goes to the Supreme Court. And in this case, all cases are settled by a 15-0 vote. But has this changed too? Sister Wendy Nelson shares an interesting statement that seems to demonstrate that the process by which things are discussed and decided among the 12 today perhaps is also changing. This is what she said a few years back when her husband had recently become the church's new president. Quote, it's as though he's been unleashed. He's free to finally do what he came to earth to do. He's free to follow through with things he's been concerned about, but never could do anything about. Now that he's president, he can do those things. We must all assume that Elder Nelson, over the course of 34 years, even while serving as the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, shared his opinions openly and unabashedly, as President Eyring and Elder Scott have explained, and apparently was unsuccessful in persuading his brethren to what he felt inspired to do. Until he became the church's president, he was apparently not able to get unanimous support for his ideas. Perhaps a good example of this is with President Nelson's efforts to get everyone to call the church by its full name. His first talk in General Conference about this subject was given in April of 1990. Although he would have petitioned his brethren in the church to follow his inspired prompting back then, he obviously did not prevail in persuading everyone. Then in 2018, as the church's president, Nelson made a decision that everyone conformed to his preferences on this matter and called the topic now not negotiable. He ended the debate that even President Hinckley had said was not that big of a deal. They could do worse, President Hinckley lovingly teased as the audience laughed, then went on to say that Mormon, according to Joseph Smith, means more good, and that we should rejoice that we are known by such a wonderful nickname. President Hinckley made those remarks in a response to Elder Nelson's talk from the previous conference, almost as if to lovingly correct the newer apostle. After all, what would be General Conference without the story of Joseph F. Smith, who replied to the angry mob of men who asked him if he was a Mormon. Yes, sirree, dyed in the wool, true blue, through and through. How did President Nelson go about getting the unanimity of his brethren who in years past did not agree with him. Were the brethren consulted this time around? Did they re-debate the issue? Or did President Nelson just demand this course correction? In his own words, he said, quote, "I did this because the Lord impressed upon my mind," I assume he's referring to 1990, "the name he decreed for his church. And he is offended when we use those nicknames ourselves." A nickname, I might add, that Joseph Smith used, as well as every other church leader since him, all the way up through President Monson. They all agreed upon or came up with the following names: the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Mormon Doctrine, the Mormon Church, Mormon News, Mormon Radio, Mormon Pioneers, Mormon Day at the Park with Paul Dunn. Most recently, the I Am a Mormon campaign, MormonandGay.com, and the movie Meet the Mormons. Did all these prophets offend the Lord by not only allowing us to be called by this nickname for 188 years, but who also encouraged it? And now we hear talks warning members that anyone using the word Mormon to refer to the church is probably an enemy to the church. One LDS person online went as far as to say the word Mormon to them is as offensive as the N-word is for blacks. It's hard for me to read. Do the brethren now give some higher priority to ideas advanced by the president that allows him to be quote-unquote unleashed? Do they no longer consider themselves as equals, all prophets, seers, and revelators, and no longer demand unanimity? Or do they not still debate each other on these issues? Perhaps President Nelson is advancing his ideas he's always wanted to do but couldn't under the pretense of a united first presidency. The late church historian D. Michael Quinn has written about the power struggles that exist between the president, the first presidency, and the 12th. Perhaps this is why President Nelson replaced President Uchtdorf with Elder Oaks, a move that was rather unprecedented. Someone that he knew and has known for many years that he may have had more in common with than President Uchtdorf. Is it possible that the 12 apostles no longer feel able to vote down a proposal brought forth by a united first presidency without their own fears of being on the high road to apostasy? I think we would all do well to remember that the entire foundation of the church and of our mortal existence here is predicated upon our ability to make choices for ourselves and upon our consent to be led by others, never by force, never by compulsion. In interest of time, I'll close with this. What is the cost of potentially losing common consent in the church? What are the implications if any newly called president becomes unleashed and is able to do all the things he's ever wanted to do but couldn't? And is it healthy to place so much trust in a leader, even though he be a prophet? Another quote we often hear in General Conference from Brigham Young is, quote, I am more afraid that this people have so much confidence in their leaders that they will not inquire for themselves of God whether they are led by him. I am fearful they settle down in a state of blind security, trusting their eternal destiny in the hands of their leaders with a reckless confidence that in itself would thwart the purposes of God in their salvation and weaken that influence they could give to their leaders. Did they know for themselves by the revelations of Jesus that they are in the right way? Let every man and woman know by the whispering of the Spirit of God to themselves whether their leaders are walking in the path the Lord dictates or not. In conclusion, the rapid changes we now see in the church, I think, do seem to reflect a further loss of this common consent that has been eroding for many decades. The church, like our nation, had a very sturdy system of checks and balances in place that were intended to prevent changes from being made without the consent of the governed. Sadly, it seems that we have let the subtle secret combination of taking away people's power to choose get above us. If not corrected, our minds will continue to be darkened. We will depend upon the commandments of men in all things, and such a people who are so unequal and so incompetent cannot ever hope to be saved or to build Zion. The good news for us is the restoration is to be rescued. And if anything, seeing these institutions that we love fail, as hard as that is a sign of his coming once again to restore all things. We can place our trust in him. We can turn to him with all our hearts. The power, it turns out, cannot be controlled by men. He and they, the powers of the very heavens, are coming. And through him, we have the power to have our hearts changed and to repent and to be born again so that we are not burned at their coming. Thank you.